Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Living in the age of social distancing is hard, especially when you can't meet with your community while on your path toward recovery.
It feels absolutely foreign and alien to me. The entire concept of recovery is built on the sense of doing anything other than isolating.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, April 8th, we hear how COVID-19 has affected people in recovery from addiction. Then we head to Wisconsin, where people took to the polls for a contentious primary election. And later, the challenges of remote learning for children with disabilities.
There wasn't much time to do some prep work and to train teachers better, to make sure that the platforms were working correctly and that, quite honestly, everybody had access to the technology and broadband that you need to do those programs.
Let's get started. Listen, we know there's a lot of news in D.C. this week, with President Trump removing two inspectors general involved in oversight and the ongoing leadership collapse of the Navy. Congress is also working on the next phase of relief bills, and it's a blur of things happening at the top. And so a lot of people dealing with the COVID-19 era can get lost in the shuffle. We don't want that to happen here. As the death toll continues to rise and social distancing becomes the norm, one group is facing a unique challenge. People in recovery from addiction have seen their support systems, including meetings like Alcoholics Anonymous, disappear or change. We spoke to a number of people in various stages of recovery about this moment and what happens when isolation is forced on a population that relies on connection for hope and even survival.
It feels absolutely foreign and alien to me. The entire concept of recovery, specifically recovery from addiction and substance use disorders, is built on this sense of community, this sense of belonging, this sense of doing anything other than isolating.
That's Ryan Hampton.
I'm the author of American Fix, Inside the Opioid Addiction Crisis and How to End It, and I'm also a person in long-term recovery from opioid use disorder.
Ryan lives in Las Vegas and has been sober for just over 5 years. Like a lot of others, his in-person meetings and services have moved online to platforms like Zoom.
Look, I am fortunate enough to be able to participate in these digital meetings because I have a smartphone. I have access to internet. A lot of people don't even have access to just regular phones, let alone smartphones. So they don't even have the tools to be able to plug into this digital infrastructure that's kind of the gap filler right now, given COVID. Even though we've got all these digital tools at our fingertips, and I've probably attended more recovery meetings in the last, 2 weeks, there's still this very real element that's missing, which is just that human-to-human interaction in person.
Ryan says he's most worried about those in early recovery or who are trying to take their first steps toward getting help.
There's so many people out there who are either just getting introduced to the concept of recovery, or they're still struggling and looking for help right now. And there's just very limited options and literally no options, zero options for having like actual human contact and human community. That's where a lot of my concern goes, because I can tell you, if COVID would have happened in, November of 2014, when I was looking for treatment for the last time, and when I was on the streets homeless on the corner of Hollywood and Highland, like ready for help, I may be dead right now. That is the honest to God truth.
And while individual groups scramble to help as many people as possible during this time, Ryan also has a bigger picture on his mind, and he can't shake it.
When people can't find jobs and when people don't have that meaningful human connection and when recovery centers aren't able to bring in people who need help, or there's more barriers to treatment or recovery support groups, or harm reduction is a whole other piece. We don't have the same type of harm reduction that we had prior to COVID-19 because the teams aren't going out on the ground and distributing clean syringes and fentanyl test strips. We know that those all create kind of this perfect storm for more overdoses. My fear is that we are going to come out of the COVID crisis maybe and flattening that curve. But what we're going to see is this entire new curve spike of overdose deaths. I mean, it's almost certain that that's going to happen.
I just think back when I got sober, how impossible it felt, you know, without what's going on now. So I think it would be terrifying.
That's Lauren Hamilton. We spoke to her last year on The Takeaway for our series, Life After Overdose.
I'm an attorney in Cleveland, Ohio. This is my fiance, Dan Freck.
I work in finance for a nonprofit.
Lauren's still sober since the last time we spoke. She's at 21 months now. They live together in Cleveland, Ohio, and attend their virtual AA meetings together, too.
It's gone off a lot more smoothly than I expected it to. To be able to log on to the computer and see familiar faces every day, I think, is keeping a lot of us sane.
But it's still a struggle with hard days.
Now is like the kind of time you think the addict in your brain thinks, like, I could totally get away with relapsing right now, you know. If we didn't show up to work, you know, it wouldn't be as noticeable.
Right, you call in, you tell them you're feeling sick.
Right.
They're going to be like, oh, don't do anything, you know, it's like.
Yeah, and especially if you're someone who's alone in your house. Like, it can be reminiscent of those days when you were drinking or using, because so many of us were doing that alone. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that can be triggering for people. I've had a lot of dreams about using since this whole virus thing started. So I don't know what that is, but probably just my subconscious kicking in, you know, over time to keep me sober.
Like Ryan, Lauren and Dan are also really worried about newcomers to recovery. Those people who are especially vulnerable, even without a global pandemic for a backdrop.
We picked someone up over the weekend who had been locked in their house drinking themselves to death. We dropped her off at the hospital, but like we couldn't come in with her.
I was really struck by that moment when we pulled up to the emergency room and dropped her off because, you know, she was pretty intoxicated but got a wheelchair for her. And there are all these guys standing outside with masks on their faces telling me I can't go in. She's one of my sponsees. So she was like crying and really scared and like begging me to come in with her, you know, and I couldn't. They weren't letting anyone in but patients. And that's the isolation. That's like what I think of.
Right.
You know, what it's like to be a newcomer right now or to still be using is like, you're going to be isolated. Even if you are, she was asking for help and we were helping her. But in the end, she had to go into that emergency room alone.
From Las Vegas to Cleveland and now to Washington, D.C. That's where we virtually meet Danielle Torino.
I'm the president and CEO of Young People in Recovery.
Danielle is also a person in long-term recovery. In the middle of this pandemic, she says her organization is trying to help young people in recovery connect with resources, including help finding housing and employment, even though they can no longer engage in person.
At this point, the engagement with people, especially people in early recovery, so in treatment or just out of treatment or recently involved in the criminal justice system, those first few weeks, months, years in recovery are fundamental for the way that we engage with people and the way that we provide social connectivity. And so we have our many anxieties about what it means to now be engaging with people on the phone or via video instead of in person.
Another challenge right now for Danielle and other people who do this kind of work is navigating what the federal legislation around COVID-19 means for people seeking treatment or those who are in recovery.
We are concerned in a couple of different states. I've heard, you know, some chatter among my colleagues in those places that they're worried that the types of behavioral health professionals that our people need the most will be left out of those law relaxations.
But amidst all this uncertainty, there's also been some joy.
I had the ability to call into an all-recovery meeting in Rockport, Texas, and be there and be a part of it and connect with people on the ground. And it was all women in this meeting, and it was very intimate and beautiful. And, you know, I'm also a person in long-term recovery, and so I understand deeply on what it means to be in early recovery and scared and nervous and feeling isolation. So the ability to connect with our own people has been wonderful.
And there's been a little bit of that beauty and joy for our final voice, too.
I'm David, and I am coming up on 26 years of clean and sober.
David's in his 60s, and he's lived most of his adult life here in New York City. He regularly attends two different AA meetings, both of which are now online.
It is nice in an odd way because I have seen people geographically who are now far away. They used to go to this meeting. Now they live in California. My friend John in San Francisco suddenly was at the meeting because he could be. And he came just to see everybody else. There was a gentleman who was looking for a gay meeting and he doesn't have one where he lives. And he found our Zoom number and came in and said, "This is so nice to have a primarily gay meeting. I feel even more comfortable. I don't have one near me in the rural place I live."
And while a number of people we spoke to have talked about what's missing from these meetings versus their in-person counterparts, David was surprised to discover this.
It's funny because in a strange way, it's more intimate because with a Zoom meeting, you're seeing each other face to face the way you and I are right now. Now, if I was in an AA meeting, I'd be in rows of chairs and possibly the person talking would be behind me. I might glance over my shoulder to see who they are. I probably know them. I know most everybody at my meeting. But you're not looking at them, and you're not looking at them as close as we are. Suddenly, there's an intimacy that I did not expect on Zoom. And now people are doing what we do live, which is they're coming into the meeting 10, 15 minutes earlier to chat with each other, kind of hanging around, how you doing, what's going on. And that's what I thought I would miss too, of just the friendships and relationships. But we're making a way to make that happen.
But David says there has been some ugliness in this process of adapting to AA online.
The trouble we've run into is that people have Zoom bombed the meetings, which I thought was specific to AA, but sadly I'm learning it happens in lots of Zoom gatherings. Somehow they get into the chat feature, and in this case, because it's a primarily gay meeting, they spew horrible homophobic slurs. I can't repeat what they say because it's really vulgar, and it repeats like someone's holding a key down, like they hit repeat. The same phrase will fill the screen. And it was sort of freakish when it first happened.
David says his group is figuring out how to keep the vitriol out of the meetings with more protection, while trying to keep as much of a virtual open door to AA newcomers as possible. Across the country, the people we spoke to all had similar messages about how you can help those who might be struggling with addiction or just struggling in general.
Call and check in on your friends, especially if you haven't heard from them.
Please check in with your loved ones. Check in with your family members.
If you have people in your life who relapse or who you think are drinking too much, try to be compassionate and supportive rather than judgmental.
I don't think it matters if you're close to them or not. And we're in the whole world is in this very strange and scary times. Even a stranger reaching out to you, you know, could make the difference.
Please find a way to instill a little bit of hope in those that are around you, and empathy and understanding. You know, one of the best ways to do that is just by reaching out, being open, having conversations with them, telling somebody that you love them, that you believe in them, that we are gonna get through this together. Because I've had multiple conversations just in the last 2 days of people who feel that they just don't know if they can get by one more day. Tell them that they can.
Many thanks to all the people we spoke to for this story. And if you're in recovery or seeking help and would like to connect virtually with others in this moment, some folks we spoke to recommended heading to Google's Recover Together site, where you can find a whole host of resources, including a list of online AA groups. That's at recovertogether.withgoogle.com. You can also call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration's National Helpline 24 hours a day. That's at 1-800-662-HELP. Yesterday, in the middle of the COVID-19 worldwide pandemic, thousands of Wisconsin voters stood in line at the polls, taking part in the state's primary and local elections. It was the result of a tense back and forth between the state's Democratic governor, the Republican-led state legislature, and the U.S. Supreme Court. On Monday, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers tried to postpone the election with an executive order after unsuccessfully pleading with Republicans in the state. But the state Supreme Court shot down the emergency order. Republicans also sued to block the governor's attempt to extend the deadline for mail-in voting. And the U.S. Supreme Court sided with Republicans, ruling that the extension was not allowed. As the number of COVID-19 cases in the state continues to rise, public health experts express their opposition to keeping the polls open for Election Day. Joining to help us understand how it all went down is Mayan Silver, a reporter with WUWM in Milwaukee. Mayan, thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, you're welcome.
There's so much here. And before we get into kind of the politics of all this, can you tell me what the polls looked like yesterday? And did a lot of people actually show?
Yeah, so I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is the state's largest city, and there were lines galore. So what happened was there are generally 180 polling places, neighborhood polling places throughout Milwaukee, and they were consolidated to five voting centers because of a shortage of poll workers. And so you can imagine with five voting centers, turnout was expected to be maybe 40 to 50,000. It seems like it was maybe more like 20,000, 25,000, but still that's thousands of people rolling through these voting centers, and they were big high schools in gyms, and there were lines snaking out of the building. There were many people in masks. They were trying to socially distance, but sometimes it didn't always work because when voters left the polls, you know, sometimes they'd be walking by other people. So poll workers I talked to called it surreal and dystopian and said that's how voters were calling it too.
Were those poll workers scared to show up for this because of all the closeness and people packed together?
Yeah, there were plenty of poll workers that did not show up for the election. In fact, election officials were telling the state that over 50% or about 50% of poll workers are over the age of 60 in general in Wisconsin elections. And so that contributed to the large shortage of poll workers. In fact, they called out the National Guard to come and work at the elections throughout the state. There were like 2,000 to 2,500 National Guard members. But there were plenty of poll workers that had to stay home, whether it was because of health issues, age, because they were just scared. They didn't want to expose themselves for such long periods. But then some other people did pick up and feel like they had a civic duty to do it if they were able to.
And just briefly, what do we know at this point about the results in general of the elections yesterday?
So that was all tied up with part of the litigation that was happening. There was tons of legal battles that were happening throughout the course leading up to this election. And I think we're expecting a lot more legal battles potentially afterwards. But at one point, there was a federal lawsuit brought by Democrats, and the judge ruled that there could be an extension of some of the limitations on when mail-in ballots could be received. So he allowed them to be received by April 13th. And the Supreme Court eventually got an appeal in that case. They ruled that if absentee ballots are postmarked by yesterday evening, they could be received all the way up to April 13th. So basically, we're not going to get any results until Monday, April 13th.
What was the governor trying to do when attempting to postpone the election? And when did he actually want to hold the thing?
Kind of the drama started about 2 weeks before when the Safer at Home order came into place. At first, the governor seemed to be on board with in-person voting. But as things got worse and COVID started getting worse and it started getting closer to the election, the governor started pushing vote by mail. And then Governor Evers did try to change or delay the election. So Governor Evers was trying to convert the election to an all mail-in election and send ballots to every registered voter. The GOP legislative leaders were calling that a statewide invitation to voter fraud. And so they put the kibosh on that. And then last Friday, as COVID kept getting worse, Evers asked the legislature to convene a special session to come into session and actually delay the election, because the governor had been saying that he didn't have the authority to delay the election on his own. And so then Republicans just gaveled in and out of that special session within minutes the next day, taking no action. Meanwhile, there's a lot of litigation going on, and there were some lawsuits to try to delay the election. But then ultimately, this past Monday, Governor Evers asked to postpone the election, and he issued an executive order to end in-person voting and to move the election to June 9th. The GOP leaders immediately appealed that to the state Supreme Court, which is leaning conservative. Within 5 hours, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ordered that Evers didn't have the authority to delay the election.
This has been such a high-profile drama. Do you think there's any chance that this could be a template, functional or not, for how other states might handle, you know, the primary elections coming up as we move closer to the presidential election?
So I think that this is a definite lesson as to why states need to be prepared so that voters aren't disenfranchised. People would request absentee ballots within the deadline and then not get them sent to them. At this point, the election officials are recording a shortfall of about 9,000 ballots that had been requested but not sent out by clerks in time. So those people had to go to the polls. And so people, there was arguments that there's voter suppression of minorities and young people in urban areas because that's where the lines were, that's where the voting centers, there was long waits and people couldn't wait due to age or job restrictions. So there were a lot of problems with this election, and ultimately it's a lesson that states have to be prepared not to disenfranchise their voters. And as Reed Epstein of the New York Times wrote, this whole situation can be seen as a culmination of a decade of efforts of Republicans in the state to make voting harder with voter ID and to somewhat dilute the power of voters in the state's urban areas.
Mayan Silver, a reporter with WUWM in Milwaukee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Tanzina Vega. Unemployment numbers continue to soar in the U.S. due to the coronavirus. That leaves millions of Americans trying to secure some sort of income to pay their bills. But filing for unemployment benefits has proven to be a challenge because so many people are trying to get benefits at the same time. The federal government passed the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, or the CARES Act, which will expand unemployment insurance to help those affected by the virus. This can all be pretty confusing, so we brought in Kevin DeLibon, who's an attorney with Legal Aid of Arkansas, to answer some questions about this new act and other ways you can get assistance. First, we asked Kevin what the CARES Act is exactly.
Congress, with the most recent CARES Act, has made a new kind of unemployment that, for the purposes of this interview, I'll just call special unemployment for people who normally couldn't qualify for the state's normal unemployment program. Self-employed people, people who may not have a really long work history with their job, maybe they just started.
So let's say that you've lost your job because of this pandemic. Should you apply through your state, through the CARES Act, through both? Like, what do you do?
So the states are all going to be in charge for processing applications for either normal or special unemployment.
Okay.
So you want to make your application with your state. If you're not eligible under normal unemployment, they may go ahead and deny you. The federal government just came out with guidance over the weekend about the special unemployment program, and many states like Arkansas haven't yet developed the ability to actually process those applications and approve those applications. It's not up to you to know whether you qualify for normal or special unemployment. The most important thing is to apply, and then if you get denied for normal unemployment, you may need to apply again for special unemployment at a later time when your state gets the things in place that are, they need to process the applications.
So it sounds like you're saying don't give up if you get dinged once.
Definitely don't give up.
Okay.
Ever during any of this. And it's going to be supremely frustrating. And we know that.
Is there a waiting period for getting benefits or even for applying for benefits if you've just lost work because of the virus?
No. Normally, many states have a 1 week waiting period. The federal legislation has pretty much done away with that. And I think most states on their own have also done away with that. So once you lose your job, you're going to want to apply for unemployment as quickly as possible.
A lot of people have said they can't get through either online, on the phone, and they're really frustrated trying to apply for benefits. What advice do you have for people who are trying to get their benefits?
First, we know that even in the best of times, benefits are really hard to get, whether we're talking about unemployment or Medicaid or SNAP. Agencies have been left underfunded for a long time. And so even the best of intentions that staff may have are difficult to realize in the best of times. Now that we have this pandemic, so many more people need social services than ever before. And that frustration level is going to go through the roof because agencies are understaffed and they can't answer phones and websites are breaking and all of this stuff. What people need to do throughout all this is document everything. So every time that you tried to call, write the time, write who you talked to, if you're able to get through to somebody. If you can't get through to somebody, just if you can take a screenshot of all your attempted calls. When you're on the website, make sure that you keep a copy of the completed application. Take screenshots. If it breaks down and you don't get through at all, then you need to document that as well. If you're in person, you might be expecting long waits, but you're going to want to know, when did you get there? What documentation did you give them? Take screenshots of the application if you filled it out on a paper application and just document everything.
What about other programs that people should think about, you know, beyond unemployment, if they are facing financial hardship, if they're having trouble putting food on the table?
The quickest way to get sort of money into your pocket may be the SNAP program, which many people still know as food stamps.
Right.
If you've lost income as a result of the COVID-19 outbreak, you may be eligible for expedited processing, which can get benefits into your pocket as quick as 7 days. Also, many states are giving people the maximum amount of SNAP benefits that you would get for a household of whatever your size is. So maybe you're on your own and normally you only get 20 or 30 bucks of SNAP, but with emergency SNAP, you can get the full amount for your household, which would be $194 for a person of one.
Wow.
And this is going to be particularly important for the people who don't qualify for normal unemployment, because that special unemployment program, depending on your state, may not be available to you for several weeks. And so there really is no other bridge benefit other than SNAP that can get some money into your pockets. People may be eligible for TANF if they have children in the home.
Temporary assistance for needy families.
Exactly. And what many people consider cash welfare benefits. The other thing we, of course, encourage folks to do is consider applying for Medicaid, which is pretty much the main way that low-income folks can get health insurance in the United States. Medicaid program rules vary from state to state, and some states haven't expanded Medicaid so that everybody could potentially be eligible. But applying for Medicaid is some way to at least get some sort of health insurance if you meet the income rules.
There are some changes also to sick leave under the CARES Act. What should people know about that?
As part of the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which was passed just before the CARES Act, Congress enacted a scheme for paid sick leave. For full-time workers, you can basically get 2 working weeks off. For part-time workers, it just depends on what your average is. You have to be unable to work or telework because of some sort of connection to COVID. And if you can establish that, you can get that time off. It can be as much as 100% of your regular pay. If it's for because you're sick yourself or advised to quarantine or have symptoms, that only applies for people who are unable to work or telework. If you need to care for your son or daughter and the school is closed because of the pandemic, in that situation, you may be able to receive up to 10 more weeks of paid time off for the amount of up to $200 per day. It's basically 2/3 of your normal salary.
You know, there are going to be people listening to this who maybe have never been laid off before, maybe never applied for benefits. Are there things they should know going into that process that you think could make this easier for them?
One thing to know is just that it's going to be frustrating. Again, in the best of times, so at Legal Aid, we help people with very low incomes all the time, all year round. And again, under the best of circumstances, accessing these benefits can be very hard. Even state caseworkers who have the best of intentions and are good public servants are often working in an environment that's really stressful, and they're understaffed, and it's difficult. Now, because of the huge demand, it's going to be even more so. So be prepared to be patient. I know that's easy for me to say and hard to do, but it's one thing you're going to have to do. You're going to have to persist, document everything. If you are mailing anything and can afford it, send things via certified mail. Just think in terms of things going wrong and you having to prove that you did what you were supposed to do at some later point. The other thing to know is that there are legal aid organizations in every state. Now, we're nonprofits. We have our own resource issues. There's not enough of us to go around. But your local legal aid organization should have some sense of what's going on in your state and be able to help you if you apply for benefits and are denied or think that the amount you're getting is wildly wrong. We are attorneys that provide our services for free in civil legal matters like unemployment or other public benefits.
Kevin DeLeban is an attorney with Legal Aid of Arkansas. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Lizzie.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. During the coronavirus outbreak, school districts across the country have had to quickly pivot to online and distance learning. And that's caused a wide range of challenges, particularly for students who don't have internet access at home. But for many of the roughly 7 million students in public schools who are receiving special education services, the transition has been even more complicated. It's meant the loss of in-person speech and physical therapy and critical face-to-face learning that just can't be replicated remotely. We asked parents of children with disabilities what their experiences have been like in this moment.
My name is Brittany, and I'm calling from Hickory, North Carolina. I am a parent to a almost six-year-old boy who has autism spectrum disorder and also a couple developmental disabilities and a speech disability. Ever since the COVID-19 crisis, it's been difficult. It's been hard to get him to get into what I like to call the zone to complete his work. He's not interested in doing schoolwork at home.
Parents and teachers of students with disabilities, you can keep calling us to share your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now, the phrase child with disabilities sounds pretty broad, but it's also a legal term defined under the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. Here's how John Eisenberg, the executive director of the National Association of State Directors of Special Education, explains it.
It is a term that represents a variety of different disability categories, including things like autism spectrum disorders, intellectual disabilities, vision, hearing. Students who qualify for IDEA have to have a disability and also have to have adverse educational impact, meaning the disability itself has to affect their educational performance in school.
I spoke with John about how different districts have been managing the switch to online and distance learning for students with disabilities. And we were also joined by Sean Smith. He's a professor of special education at the University of Kansas. Sean's research is focused on the use of technology in special education, and he told me that certain online approaches tend to work better for students with disabilities.
Technologies like text-to-speech that are built into a lot of the tablets and computers our students are using, if they have access to digital text, will read it out loud to them, highlight the word as it's being read. There's other technologies that actually potentially adjust the reading level. There's also technologies that allow students to share what they know in different ways. For example, instead of a traditional essay, they may create a little podcast or a movie or an interactive poster. And those things have been seen as positive things in the online learning environment.
And what hasn't worked as well?
There's a bit of a list there. One of the most significant challenges in some of our work that was identified, especially at the elementary and early middle school level for students with disabilities, has been the need of an adult engagement at home. Some of the online schools will call them a learning coach. And I think that's a very good term. A lot of parents in studies that we've conducted shared that they saw themselves as a paraeducator or as a tutor or even as a child teacher. And it makes sense. I mean, if you take them into an online home environment, they need to be there to be able to support their child. And it's more than just simply to be there for, an attendant. It's that implementing a lot of the ideas, the strategies, the supports that they generally need face-to-face, and they'll still need face-to-face, but just there at home. So that responsibility of the parent takes on a much larger role than I would argue for some of our students that may be independent readers. These are areas of concern and lead to a lot of identification for our students with disabilities. So the adult in the home is almost a must.
Well, that sounds like a real potential stumbling block if the parent is an essential worker or just needs to be, you know, going to work for economic reasons right now.
What we have found is it might be the grandparent, it might be the teenager, or it may be the fact that they're doing it different hours. They're coming in from work, and so education starts in the evening, or education's early morning. It's not during that traditional time because they're at work. And those are things that schools, I think, very much need to realize and plan around, because there's ways to empower parents. There's ways to facilitate what we do at a distance and online that are planful for and designed so that we can reduce that need for that adult to support and reduce the need for the child to be as organized as we would expect, et cetera. But yes, it would be also planned and mindfully planning around the demands of the home as well.
John Eisenberg, this has happened in lots of different districts across the country. And I guess I'm wondering, how has the transition worked? Were school districts prepared? Were some better than others? How'd it go?
I think your second point is probably the most accurate, where it's been some districts have had a lot of experience with virtual education versus some who have had no experience. And then some folks have adopted certain platforms and some didn't even have a platform. So I think it's honestly district by district, a unique experience. I think the folks who have dabbled and have experience in it probably are definitely farther ahead. And this was an easier transition for them. But we are hearing that there's a lot of teachers, a lot of parents and students struggling to make that quick transition. There wasn't much time to do some prep work and to train teachers better, to train the students better, to make sure that the platforms were working correctly and that, quite honestly, everybody had access to the technology and broadband that you need to do those programs. So it's honestly unique by each district to each district.
Does it correspond exactly to money and how wealthy different districts are? Or, you know, are there schools and districts that are doing this well with less funding?
I think the funding is a critical piece that has started to emerge as one of the key discussion items that people are asking for additional needs with Congress. It wasn't heavily in the first round of funding, but there are a number of national organizations like ours and others who now know that we need to plan again for the next time something like this might happen, and that we need to have robust systems in place, and that significant financial resources are going to need to be had. But there are places that have experience using these systems. They are not cheap, and it depends on sort of how the district leadership has looked at investing in these options. Many states have gone in their graduation requirements to add key components where they're requiring students to take a virtual course before they graduate, because they know the modern workforce, you need to be able to use that technology.
Sean, do you have any advice for schools that are still trying to figure out how to make this work or make it work better for students and families?
One, I think, big area would be to focus in from both the district perspective as well as the school perspective to facilitate with our educators, both our related service providers, so speech and language pathologists, as well as our teachers, the big ideas. What's critical? What's essential? And a lot of our students with disabilities are spending the majority of their academic day in the general education classroom. So we want to make that point. And so therefore, online, they're still working, or at a distance, they're still being taught by their general education teacher. So for that teacher, it may be that, well, I like that lesson, or I like these series of lessons, or we generally cover this content, But when I reflect back to what's really, really critical, what those standards are really asking us to do, and what the big ideas are to make certain everyone knows here before the end of this academic year, let's concentrate on that. First of all, that's going to allow me to declutter a bit. It's going to allow me to realize I have more time to potentially to focus in on those essential elements. And then next, I can look at the venue I have in front of me. And of course, I'm talking about as if we have access to critical digital tools. So we Right. have actually online learning. And then looking at the tools that are being provided that can help facilitate that.
I think a lot of parents right now are just trying to process, what does all of this mean for my kid this year? Sean, do you have a sense of what the longer term impact of 6 months or a year learning in this way could have on students with disabilities?
Well, that is definitely a concern. As a parent of a child with disability myself, as well as other children that would be deemed typically developing, there's a reason we have face-to-face instruction. In special education, actually, during this summer, we have something called extended school year, and that's something that not all students with disabilities receive. But those that do receive it, it's been shown that they need it because there will be regression if they don't receive that type of support. And while online learning has a number of benefits, and there's a lot of potential positives here, there's a reason we do face-to-face. And so the extended time away as a parent, I think there will be things that we'll have to compromise on. And back to my big ideas, we can focus on certain areas, but there'll be other things, potentially, let's say, that speech and language support that is so critical potentially for that face-to-face or the occupational therapy or physical therapy or that adaptive physical education support by the physical education teacher that can really work with my son or daughter with their level of expertise. Those are going to be things that we'll need to catch up on, or we'll need to look at different ways when we're back to whatever the new normal is.
John, there is a provision in the stimulus package that Congress passed that allows the Department of Education to waive some of the federal special education requirements. What do you think about that right now?
As an organization, we have put forth with a number of other organizations, we signed a joint letter with the Council of Administrators of Special Education asking the Secretary of Education not to waive parts of IDEA. We think the word waiver is a bad word, so to speak, and we are concerned about waiving anything that has civil rights protections in it. What we really need is some additional flexibility on some very specific components of IDEA, including some flexibility around timelines. IDEA is one of the most prescriptive federal laws on the books because there are absolute requirements and timelines, and if you don't hit timelines, there are consequences. And there are key components of that where states, there's just no way with the way things currently exist, are going to be able to meet some of those timelines. So flexibility there. And then also on some of the data and documentation that we're required to collect is just not going to be possible during this period of time. And so we're looking for some temporary relief in that area, but not waiving accountability. And then this really third big piece is there are spending requirements of part of IDEA that we're going to need some either flexibility or holds on until all this mess gets sorted out. So we absolutely believe there needs to be flexibility, but first and foremost, it's the health and safety of our students, teachers, administrators, and state level people have to come first. And we're going to need some flexibility in order to survive this in the near future.
Sean, you mentioned your son. He's 19, has Down syndrome. And I'm wondering what advice you have to parents or grandparents, guardians of students who are adjusting to distance learning, online learning, and just kind of getting through this right now.
Well, the first thing I think is to really realize the fact that they have a new role. And while they've been active with their child, maybe with homework and other types of school support, they're taking on a new role. And therefore, looking at how they can make time for that new role, understanding, reaching out to their educators to determine what that role is going to look like, how can they be more engaged, et cetera, et cetera. The second thing, and that's a big et cetera, et cetera. The second thing to me is that oftentimes as parents, particularly parents of children with disabilities, I think we look to the schools to communicate with us. And John was talking about a number of different meeting obligations and things of that nature. And those are good examples where the district is in charge and they'll facilitate the process and we respond to it. In this new online distance education format, we need to be an equal, if not potentially even more proactive, in reaching out and finding times to regularly communicate. I would advocate, based on our research, that it needs to be weekly. Now, it may be phone calls, 30 minutes, or it could be 15 minutes. It would be pre-planned. We have a specific questions we're going to ask, specific questions we're going to answer. It could be for a reason. We're going to problem solve this task. Teacher is going to teach me this so I can model it with my child. But very proactive communications that I don't believe emails, I don't believe text directions from teachers are going to do it for a portion of our population with disabilities. I'm not advocating for this for every single child receiving an education. I don't think that's possible for all our educators. But just like we've had with students with special needs in the past, these periodic unique things would go a long way in supporting those parents and empowering them and being able to support their children at home.
Sean Smith is a professor of special education at the University of Kansas. John Eisenberg is the executive director of the National Association of State Directors of Special Education. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
For parents and teachers of students with disabilities, we wanted to hear from you on this. How are you feeling about your child or student's progress?
Hi, my name is Steve. I'm a parent and teacher in Islip, Long Island. And I have a son with a mild case of ADD. It's interesting to be home with him because I get to see the real impact of the medication that we give him, when it works, when it peaks, and what he looks like when he's working with it in him, and what he looks like when he's done with it and it's kind of worn off by 3 or 4 o'clock.
My name is Lori, and I'm calling from Richmond, Virginia. And I do have a special needs daughter. She is cognitively and physically disabled. And as much as the teachers try to help with the academics, with everything being online, the problem with the majority of our kids is that a lot of their learning is social interaction and very hands-on.
Hello, my name is Eric, and I'm calling from Reno, Nevada. I have a 13-year-old son with special needs. He's on the autism spectrum. We've transitioned to online school with him, and it's real slow going. It's hard just to get through the technical aspects of it and get it to even work right for us right now. The main thing for him that kind of breaks my heart is this socialization aspect of what he was doing at school was so important, the routine and his friends and just getting on that bus every morning and all those interactions with people was almost as important or even more important for him as the academics.
We want to keep hearing from you. You can call us on any topic at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet the show at The Takeaway. If you want to follow me, I'm at Lizzie O'Reilly on Twitter. Also, if you want to check out any of our COVID-19 coverage, you can head to thetakeaway.org/coronavirus. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.